This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Welcome back, everybody. We're just waiting on one of our speakers.
Well, as Adele said, welcome back, and shortly we'll begin our forum. Adele will introduce our four distinguished panellists who will be talking firstly about their own experience, which will then lead into a discussion. So welcome, everybody.
Thank you, Jay. Welcome, Bonnie. Great. So we have a very special group of speakers who have had experiences in children's homes or institutions, and I'd like to introduce you to Frank Golding, who's been an activist for care leaver rights since the 1990s and an active member of CLAN, the Care Leavers of Australia Network, since its inception. And he has written a book, An Orphan's Escape, Memories of a Lost Childhood. Frank has a whole range of accomplishments, and if I may pass you over to Frank, because I think he's the best to talk about his experiences.
Oh, sorry. Thanks, Caroline. I come and sit before you as a convicted person. In fact, a repeat offender, no less. I come from a family of convicted persons, actually. Two of my mother's sisters were also criminals, and before them their grandfather too was convicted of a crime. And the thing we all have in common is that we were all children at the time of our convictions. Joanna gave you a bit of an introduction to the system this morning, and that's a feature that's very much imprinted in my mind and a lot of my fellows' minds, that we were charged with crimes before the courts, before we were made wards of the state. On the first occasion, when I was 2.5, I was committed as a ward of the state of Victoria, and my offence was that under the Children's Welfare Act, my father had fallen 4 weeks in arrears of his maintenance payments. And that automatically, under that act, automatically led you to become a ward of the state. These days we call it mandatory detention, don't we? After a little while, my brother and I were released on probation. That's the term in my file, my personal record. Again, the use of penal language is very common in the children's welfare system. On the second occasion I faced a court, I was 4.5, and that offence under the Children's Welfare Act was that I was without sufficient means. I was without sufficient means. That means that I was poor, I was a vagrant, and whatever meaning you want to attach to a 4.5-year-old having not sufficient means. Before that, even back in 1865, my mother's grandfather appeared before the Ballarat magistrates at aged 11, charged with the offence of being a neglected child. He was found playing on the streets. This was before the Education Act made attendance at school compulsory. So they locked him up for 4 years on a prison ship moored off Williamstown. He absconded twice. It wasn't a great place to be, actually, with 300 other boys on a training ship. So he got a further year at Sunbury and Bayswater reformatories in Victoria. My mother seems to actually have escaped the fate of her three sisters. Two of them were made wards of the state. Jean was adopted and Minnie was placed in the care of the Ballarat Orphanage where I grew up. I didn't know this at the time. Later, when she was pregnant, she was placed in a convent. The baby was taken away and adopted out, as was the practice in those days, and we've never seen the baby or my auntie ever since. A third sister, Joyce, was also placed in the Ballarat Orphanage where she died at the age of 12. She was buried in a common graveyard without the parents being notified, no press release. The undertaker was the father of the orphanage superintendent. It was all very neat and tidy. We, a couple of years ago, managed to erect a proper name plate, a plaque for the 26 children, including my auntie, who were buried in the common grave. Up until then, they had no names. It was just simply Ballarat Orphan Asylum. So, you know, the atmosphere clearly was really very, very negative, very, very much controlled, and very much an extension of the criminal system. As for my conviction of having insufficient means, what I found in my file, and this, there are really two parts of every former ward stories, I think, that's the experience they had as children in the institutions, but also the backstory, which they often didn't get, as in my case, until I was in my mid-50s, through finding the records which told the story. It's a convoluted process still these days to actually try to find the story, the backstory, which explains why you were put in care. My parents actually got their act together and had sufficient means, but it was a further 5 or 6 years after they made petitions to get us out that we finally were able to go home, but it was not because of the kindness or the sensitivities of the authorities. It was sheerly a sheer fluke. I somehow or other found myself winning a scholarship to go to the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II in 1953. A ward of the state was not allowed to go out of the state, let alone go out of the country, but there'd been such a fuss because the Herald Sun newspaper in Victoria had sponsored this program, and such a fuss that, that there was no way other than to let me go. But to let me go meant that I had to be released from my wardship. Before that, and when I came home, the orphanage people and my parents were both at the wharf to greet me, and I was given the choice. Some choice, eh? The orphanage had written to the welfare department shortly before this all happened, and I only found this out in the last 10 years or so. Father and mother now living in Ballarat and are always in touch with him. Too much, rather a nuisance. Double underlined in the original, in somebody's handwriting. The parents are in contact with the children. That's too much and a nuisance. Nuisance for whom? Well, you'd have thought that the interests of the child were front and centre in these matters, but clearly, as Joanne has pointed out, that's not the case. And in my own case, it was clear that the interest of the child would come second to another interest. This was a note that I found from the Child Welfare Department about my education. I was in, I was coming up for year 10. I was turning 15. My two brothers had already turned 15 and they were sent out to work, one on a farm and one to a trade, neither of which was their choice. And that was clearly my fate too. Undoubtedly, all the boys, the Welfare Department wrote, all the boys will return to the mother and Golding in due course, and it's just a question of whether he should be retained and given an education at the expense of the state when his future earnings will probably be collected by the mother. In other words, we must make sure that these terrible parents don't get any benefit out of the boys' education, certainly not at the expense of the state. Now, the irony is that I was marked to go, as my brothers were, get to leave school at that year, but when I got back to my parents at the age of 15, the message was very loud and clear. You will go to school. You will continue to be at school. You will go as far as you possibly can. And they made sure I did. I went to a teacher's college. It was very helpful to have education department scholarships in those days. To university after that and became a teacher and then subsequently a school principal and so on. I had a remarkably successful career in my terms. But if I hadn't gone back to my parents, I'd have followed my two brothers' career into unskilled labour. So the welfare system was clearly intent on punishing unworthy parents, not letting them get any sort of advantage from the system. And that really leads me up to the forum today. That's by way of background to my incarceration as a state ward. My parents would not talk to me about this story at all. It was clear that they were not proud of what had happened and they didn't want to discuss the matter. So it became a closed book until I was in my mid-50s when I was told there were ward records and I could get the file which would tell the story. I was absolutely amazed at what was there. but perhaps even more amazed at what they didn't want me to have, the number of whiteouts, censorships, because it mentioned people like my mother. She only wrote to the welfare department once in all that time. My father did the writing. My mother wrote once. I wasn't allowed to have that because I wasn't allowed to have the whole letter because it mentioned someone else. That someone else was my brother. And when I got the letter after years of petitioning for it, it was such a letdown. It just told me something we'd already known about. And in fact, I'd written about in the book, The Orphan's Escape. If only they'd read the book, they would see I knew the events covered in the letter. It was just it's absolutely unbelievable, the effort people have gone to refuse you access to the full story. And it's only through perseverance and doggedness that I've actually got that full story, not in its entirety, but I've got most of the story. The fact that they will white out things where it mentions somebody else's name seems to me to be absurd, because you grew up with those people. In most cases, the whiteouts were about my parents. I needed to understand what my parents were up to for me to understand my story. I'll hand over.
Thank you. Thank you, Frank. And I think, you know, Frank's narrative, very powerful narrative, is emphasising the importance of, you know, perhaps how bureaucratic abuse may be continued with the struggle to find one's own personal narrative. So here we are discovering a sociological narrative, while those who were in homes and institutions are struggling to piece together their own personal narrative. That's part of the current history, the present. I'd like to introduce Caroline Carroll now, who is the Records and Reunions Coordinator at Open Place, the Victorian Service for Forgotten Australians. So Caroline herself is a forgotten Australian, and now she works to support other forgotten Australians. And she is the chair of the Alliance for Forgotten Australians. So again, Caroline has many personal and professional achievements, and it's with pleasure that I introduce you to Caroline Carroll.
I grew up in institutional care. I was 14 months old when I was placed, taken, and put into an orphanage. I was one of eight children. Until last year, I had met one of my siblings. Last year I met another two. And trying to build a life or a relationship with siblings that you have nothing in common with is very difficult. I had six different institutions and five different foster placements in my 15 years while I was in care. I don't ever remember asking why this was happening to me, why I lived like this. I don't think I knew that there was any other way to live. When I was just before I turned 15, I was old enough then at 15 to be kicked out and look after myself. This man walked down the path where we were gardening. When he asked for me, I nearly fell over. I'd never had a visitor the whole time I'd been in care. And it turned out he was my brother. 2 weeks later, my parents came to meet me. Again, I'd never met them, hadn't asked about them, didn't know anything about them. I was told to kiss them hello and go and sit in the garden. I've often said that I don't know who was more relieved, them or me, when the hour was up and they could leave. I had no ongoing relationship with my parents or with that brother. I'm struggling to reunite with the sister and brother that I have just met. My brother's in his 70s, my sister is in her 60s, and I'm heading that way too. So I'm not telling you how old I am. It's difficult. But what I'd really like to talk about is where the apology stands in a true process of reconciliation. For me, acknowledgement and apology are a vital beginning for any healing process. They're not enough by themselves, but they're an essential start. This really happened to you. We are sorry for our part in it. After an apology, what? There is a view that we should now move on. We've all said sorry, now get over it. But until people see that you're following up with actual reparation, money, free healthcare, or something that will start to fix our lives, they can't quite believe you mean it. Like most victims of cruelty, we find it hard to forgive. We are pretty isolated.
Is that working?
We are a pretty isolated bunch of people, despite our common experiences. Childhood trauma leads to confusion and to self-blame. At the apology, a lot of us came out of the punishment cupboard under the institutional stairs, but many more remain isolated, unwilling to accept the apology, while their own lives haven't improved at all as a result of it. The vital next step towards reconciliation is reparation. There have been some moves to put the wrongs right. Some states have paid redress. Mine hasn't. Some states make personal grants for health crises and appliances. Others supply only counselling. Services are very uneven, although the Find and Connect project will bring more national access. But why are these things not seen as our right? Another point. While the government made an honest apology, it's been marred by the continuing ignorance of the broader Australian population of the fact that the majority of us even existed. Oh yes, they say, when I tell them where I work. That's those kids who came from England. Or that's the stolen generation. And we go on having to explain. Yes, there were child migrants and there were Aboriginal people, but there were also over 400,000 children who don't fit either of those categories and remain largely unseen. This wonderful exhibition is an important tool for explaining the whole truth, and I still have hopes that it will travel and be seen widely. I also hope records and photos are being kept for a souvenir booklet or catalogue before it's packed up on the 27th of February. These are our lives and these are our stories, and they must continue to be told. Thank you.
Thank you, Caroline, very much, and needless to say, a very important awareness for us on the current challenges for forgotten Australians, which do not end when children leave the home. Thank you so much, Caroline. And with pleasure, I introduce you to our next speaker, and it's and she is the reason that I am wearing purple today. If you don't like the couture, you can blame her. And I'm also wearing the badge that she kindly gave me at the 10th anniversary of the Care Leavers of Australia Network, that anniversary event, which is the badge for the Female Factory Precinct Action Group, the purple hand, saying hands off our heritage. So wearing it specially for the back row, who'll be able to see it so clearly, but I wear it with pride, and I can let her explain the importance of purple and the importance of the Female Factory Precinct Action Group, as well as other experiences and achievements. I introduce you to Bonnie Jurek.
Thank you, Adele. Can you hear me okay? Yep. All right. I just want to start with perhaps a beginning of my journey to today. It started really in 2000 when my when that year I had two sisters die within 6 months of each other. One of my sisters was a single parent of three children, and in that situation, she really actually anticipated her death. She had been in care herself as a child and had a lot of unresolved issues. She had problems with drugs, addiction, drinking, and that sort of thing. And so she was always... I'd get these very late phone calls or 3 o'clock in the morning phone calls when she was having a binge or something, saying, "Oh, Bonnie, if anything happens to me, will you take my children? Will you look after my children?" And so anyway, the day came, and I did. I took the three children, twins and a boy, all under 10 years of age. So it was like a second family for me, because my children were quite a bit older. What happened from that point was really something I'd never expected. All of a sudden, I sort of entered a new territory. I had become a foster mother, and this triggered memories, or my mother's experience, because my mother was a foster child. She had been in care from the age of 3 to around 13. And so, and she would not talk really about her childhood, only to say things like, "Oh, Auntie Hilda, she was such a cold woman, you know, and I never got on with her," things like that. Anyway, what eventuated was I became the substitute foster mother that my mother worked out all her issues with. So you can imagine how difficult the situation was. So anyway, it really forced me to actually start looking at what was really going on. There's a family dynamic going on. There's a legacy, and Frank's also touched upon sort of the legacy, the intergenerational legacy that we have. And so I started first to explore these ideas through my art practice I was studying at the time. And then, the next step was actually going back to Parramatta Girls' Home and confronting that place and actually looking at the building and the site and everything, and which I did frequently. It was almost like a morbid fascination with this place. And... anyway, as time passed, I started to understand a little bit about the history. There were clues that I started with. Like, one of the things I remembered, there was this, as you can imagine, within an institution, children will talk and stories will be told, and we'd often hear stories of headless nuns or the sound of babies crying at night time. And, of course, Parramatta Girls' Home was a state-run institution, so there were no nuns and there were certainly no babies there at that time. But this myth, if you like, had some truth in it when I found out that the actual building was built as Australia's first government-owned orphanage for Catholic children of convict parentage. So it was built in 1841. So the next step that led me to was the boundary wall, because the home is completely confined within a very high wall, perimeter wall. Next door was what I'd always thought of as Parramatta Psychiatric Centre. Well, as the story unfolded, or the journey unfolded, I came to realise that that was Australia's first female factory, essentially the first women's refuge in Australia. And I guess at that point I started to realise, because the female factory, it's such a significant history. You know, around 9,000 women passed through that place, and a large percentage of the first generations of Australians were born there, and yet that place is neglected. No one knows its history. It's obscure. It's hidden. And I started to think, Well, if that history, which is so significant to us as Australians, is ignored, what on earth is going to happen to this home, which is even more marginalised, even more, it's such its own legacy of shame. So that's when I began campaigning for the preservation and the designation of both the female factory, which is the mother, and the Parramatta Girls' Home, or the orphanage, as the child, as a precinct that represents a history, a family history, a history of separation. First, the convict women being separated from their families in England, and then when they're taken into the factory, their children are removed from them. So this was the place where the first forced removal of children occurred in Australia. So, and then the orphanage, and then it's later on turning into an industrial school or a girls' home. So it's got this tremendous history that touches so many generations right to today. And until very recently, what was the Parramatta Girls' Home has been operating as a women's prison. So we're basically looking at 200 years or around 200 years of incarceration of women and children at one site. So it's really quite tremendous. And hence the purple hand signifies both black or Aboriginal women and white women. It's the unity between, because it is a place that, you know, when you're in an institution, there really wasn't any differentiation between you and an Aboriginal girl. You were all equally treated just as badly, if you like. So it was a great leveller in a way. And, of course, the site itself has traditional connections to the Burramatical people. According to some traditional stories, it was once a sacred woman's site. So it has so many layers of history. Anyway, I'd just like to share with you, the journey has gone on from there, and I've actually started to ask really what the apology meant. And I've really come up with this, that it really, an apology is about redemption and recovery, and it's not really about remembering. And that's why this museum is important, because it's a place where the stories can be told and that history can be put on display. Of course, there's downsides to a museum. They do keep records of numbers of people who visit the exhibitions, but they don't know much about how much time is spent with the exhibits or the display, and they don't know what people witness when they come to the museum, how it changes their lives, how it affects them. And that would be very interesting to know too. I appreciate there have been some financial constraints in putting on this exhibition, and I really do appreciate and commend the museum for doing such an excellent job of putting together the exhibition. But I also wonder what will happen once the exhibition closes. I understand there's some perhaps some interest in a travelling exhibition, which will be great. But at the end of the day, all of that is either returned to the people or boxed up. And what happens then? Is it forgotten again? That is something that really concerns me, because we need to keep this story alive. These days we've got a great deal of interest in sites of memory, and this is a worldwide movement and has been particularly driven by the events of September 11th. What people know about sites of memory or places of memory is that they can change people's perception of time, and they are places where the past and the present intermingle. And really, you can't get that in a museum. You actually can only experience, it's an experience that you can only experience in that place, in that location. One of the things that I have seen over the years with at reunions and so forth, on-site reunions, is this sort of connection that people have, people who were once in those institutions, have with these sites. Something, there's a real dynamic that goes on. It's very, it's quite intangible, but it's like a personal struggle. It's like you can almost, I guess if you want to use a metaphor, it's like someone coming out of an isolation ward, opening the door and coming into freedom in a way. It's a very, very powerful moment. And it takes a lot of courage for people to actually revisit the sites. But it does certainly, in most cases, help people resolve some of their experiences. My great passion, as I've touched upon, is campaigning for the Parramatta Female Factory Precinct, which, as I said, encompasses the convict female factory, the girls' home and the orphanage, as a memorial site to care leavers, which can then be visited and experienced. And you can go in. I think also Joanna or somebody raised the issue of you can't know what it was like in a dormitory. You can't know these things. So if a place could be set up in some area set up which could show that experience, I think that would be a wonderful thing in actually reaching out to people, particularly children, as part of this education package and that sort of thing, to really understand what went on. I'll just leave it with you now to consider what... imagine if, like Port Arthur, I imagine all of you would know Port Arthur, what would happen if developers came along, the site was sold off, everything was boxed up and then put in a museum? Think about what would be lost. That's a question I'll leave you to ponder. Thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie, for such an insightful commentary on the importance of heritage, not just challenges and opportunities posed there for our own National Museum in terms of permanency of this history, but also of the importance of sites. And really important questions, and really grateful for that, Bonnie. Thank you so much. It's with great pleasure that I introduce Derek Moriarty, or Sharkey, as he prefers to be called, who is the current president of the Old Fairbridgians Association, MOLONG. So Sharkey is best placed to talk more about the Fairbridge scheme, his work as president of the Old Fairbridgians Association, and his experience as a child migrant. Thank you, Sharkey. Welcome.
Thank you, Adele. You all hear me all right? I'll make a couple of apologies before I start. If I look nervous and sound nervous, you're right, I am. If I swear, pull me up. And if I get emotional, join me. Having said that, Adele's already touched on my name, Sharkey. My folks, when I was born, called me Derek. And my friends in 1971... when I was playing football with a local team in the Wollongong area, nicknamed me Sharkey, and I now introduce myself wherever I go as Sharkey for a number of different reasons. I was born in Chelsea, in London, in 1943, 23rd of June, the second of three illegitimate children from a relationship between my father and my mother, who had met in a displaced persons camp in England during the war. My mother left my father when I was 3 years old. My brother was one. The other child was a sister, Pauline, 2 years older than me. She took Pauline with her and left my brother and I with my father. That's one version. I have another version which says that she took the three of us with her and went back to the village, little village called Stoke and Church, which is about halfway between London and Oxford, where all her family had grown up, and those that are still alive and their children all still live in the same village or very close to it. She took us back there, and the other part of the story is that She met and married a gentleman some 5 months after she left my father. I might just add in here that my father was already married. He had a wife back in Tralee in Ireland and had two daughters with her. They were teenagers at the time. And he married this guy, and they apparently went up to Scotland on a honeymoon for a week or so. And when they came back, or while they were away, the other story is that my father came to the village and took my brother and I and said, "I'm having my boys," and took us back to London. So we never know which is the correct story, and I guess it's not really important anyway. Apparently he wasn't able to care for us, so he had a friend who had a 16-year-old daughter who had quite a serious illness but had an illegitimate child, and another girl was living with her, also 16 years of age with an illegitimate child, and my brother and I were left in their care. Apparently they used to go out and leave the four of us children in the house on our own. And somehow or other the child welfare got word of this, and we were removed from that premises. Apparently it was an absolute slum, pigsty, all sorts of other things I've heard it called. And we were placed in separate orphanages in England. I was placed in one at Hunstanton, which is on the east coast, a little seaside resort similar to Manly, only a lot smaller. And my brother went to another seaside resort some 30-odd miles away, a little place called Lowestoft. Obviously, he was so much younger, and the orphanage I went to didn't take children that young. Some 2 years later, he was brought to where I was, and I can remember very clearly the day a nurse with a blue uniform and a white cap, like nurses wore in those days, walking up the pathway with this little toddler carrying a yellow duck, and that was my brother Paul. So basically, that was the first time I had met him. I was, I think, 7 at the time, he was 5. One day in school, we come home from school, and the orphanage we were in then had about 15 children in it. It was a lovely big house, a huge house. My wife Sandra and I have visited it twice. As recently as last August, we were back there. It has since closed down and been sold to private ownership, and they're converting it into flats, unfortunately. My reason for going there was to try and find records and information about who placed me there, why, how, and then who eventually turned around and came in one day and said, "You and your brother are going to Australia." At that stage, I was 7 years of age. It was early in the year. We weren't asked where we were going or anything else. Nobody told us who'd made the decision. We were just told where we were going. A couple of months later, they took us down to London, bought us some clothes, and then took us to a little place called Kent, a place called Knockholt, another huge mansion of a house which had actually been given to the Fairbridge Foundation or the Fairbridge Society as a gift, and they used it as a holding house before the parties of children came out to Australia. So my brother and I were there for 6 weeks, and children came, we might be 2 1 week and 3 the next week, until we had a party there together of 16 children. We boarded the ship in Southampton on the 29th of August 1951 and arrived in Sydney on the 30th of September 1951. We stopped over at Fremantle on the way across, and 8 of the party went to Fairbridge in Western Australia. The rest of us went to the Fairbridge Farm School at Molong. We travelled up from the wharf in Sydney. After we disembarked, we jumped in the back of a truck which had a canvas cover over it, a wooden bench along each side, and it took us about 9 hours, I think, from memory, to get from there up to the farm school at Molong, which is out in the central west of New South Wales. I was there for 8 years, and my brother there was there for nearly 11. The reason for that was the normal leaving age was 17, but I had lots of problems and issues while I was there and decided that I wanted out. I might point out also that the first 2 years I was there, I had a cottage mother. We were in cottages with 15 or 16 children, and like most orphanages, or a lot of orphanages. And the first cottage mother I had was a gem. She was just, I can't find the words to describe her, but she, to my way of thinking, she's probably what all cottage mothers and all carers in orphanages and children's homes probably should have been like. However, she left and was replaced by, I can't describe her any more than the Wicked Witch. We called her Fanny Johnson. She was a chain smoker, used to walk around the house with a cigarette hanging out the side of her mouth, around the cottage, cigarette hanging out the side of her mouth with ash flooring all over the place, a nose running like a tap. And we used to have bets about how long the ash would be before it fell off. And she was a very, very heavy drinker, drank brandy like it was going out of style. Now, they didn't get a real lot of money, these staff, as you can imagine, but I think every penny she got went on cigarettes and brandy. But she was a sadist, an absolute sadist, as were many of the other cottage mothers there at Fairbridge. And it's been well documented. I don't really have to go over the history of Fairbridge because, like I say, there's been a number of books written about the place. Probably the most notable is David Hill's book, The Forgotten Children. If you've read it, you would have seen my name in there a couple of times, different instances. I didn't have any hesitation when David approached me about an interview and said he was writing a book. I said straight away, David, I'll give you my story, providing you don't change it, edit it, or whatever. It's exactly how it was for me. And I actually told David things that I'd never told anybody in my life, including my family, my wife and children. There's been other documentaries on the television, several articles in the newspapers and whatnot about Fairbridge, but moving on from there, I decided I'd had enough of the place. I won a scholarship to go to high school when I was 11 year old. I was a year ahead of my age in school. I was very bright, apparently. I think they said my IQ was 129 when I left England. And I won the scholarship to go to Orange High School, and in all the years that Fairbridge existed, there was probably only about 12 or 13 children went to Orange High School. David Hill was one of them, but he was kicked out because he told me the other day on the phone, he came 46 out of 46 in the class. They saw it was best he leave. I gained my intermediate certificate only just. I got the barest possible pass there. And because I was only 14, the law said I had to go to school till 15, so they made me go on. And at the end of fourth year, I think I came something like 102 out of 120 or something, so they decided it was best I leave too. I went to work on the farm, the dairy, the bakery, all the different jobs we had to do there. And I'd had enough, and I ran away with three other kids, and we hitchhiked to Brisbane. We got caught by the coppers up there, and they sent us back after a couple of weeks. I had... That's 3 weeks, I think, in the notorious Westbrook home in Queensland. And if you thought Fairbridge was a hellhole, then you should never go to Westbrook. From there, we went back to Fairbridge, got a public thrashing, which was highly illegal, but happened on a regular basis there. And then some 4 or 5 months later, two of us ran away again. And this time we hitchhiked down to Sydney, and then we're heading down the coast. We were heading to Victoria. We got caught by the police again, and we had a very friendly, understanding magistrate in the children's court in Nowra, and he asked us why did we run away, and we started to tell him. He said, I want you to put this in writing, I'll remand you for 2 weeks, and during that time I want you to write in your own words why you ran away. So they sent us up to Albion Street Boys Shelter, I think it's in Surry Hills in Sydney, for 2 weeks. And I wrote 15 pages and was just sort of starting to warm up, and they wouldn't give me any more paper. So we went back to the children's court a couple of weeks later, and the magistrate started reading it, and he asked me to stand up and wanted to know if there was anything wrong with me. And I said, yeah, I don't like Fairbridge, I want out. And he said, no, I mean with your brain. Anyway, cut the story short. He said, if Fairbridge can find you a suitable job and accommodation, I'll release you. And if not, you'll go to Mount Penang. Most of you have probably heard of Mount Penang. It was a delinquent's home. It wasn't an orphanage. The sorry part about this whole story of us going to Fairbridge too, and the worst part, as far as I'm concerned, I could talk for hours on it, but I won't, is that we were classified as orphans, which we never were. We continually, during the time that we were there, or the time that I was there, I continually asked for information about my family, why we were in Australia, who sent us here, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, the answer was continuously, we have no information, we have no details. And as my friend Frank touched on there earlier, when we were finally able to access our files, which was some 20-odd years ago, I think I got mine, I got a file from Australia and a file from England, and the information in there was just unbelievable. I finally managed to locate my mother and her side of the family in 1985. She and the stepfather came to Australia, built a house at Gosford, lived for 2 years, sold it, was a mansion, sold it, went back to England, and back to the same village. As far as my father goes, I never met my father, knew nothing about his side of the family until January last year, and by a sheer fluke, probably one in 500 million chances, something was seen by somebody on a website, and it's a long story too, but we managed to locate a cousin in Tralee. We got in contact straight away, lots of emails backwards and forwards, and Sandra and I were able to visit them last year due to the assistance of the Family Restoration Fund, which was set up by the British government and administered by the Child Migrants Trust. We had, I did anyway, I stayed there 2 weeks, Sandra was there for 3 or 4 days, and then she went to visit some of her family in Liverpool. But I had the most wonderful 2 weeks probably of my life. It was just the sheer joy of finding family on my father's side and going through the history of Tralee, because he was born and raised in Tralee and married a girl from Tralee, although they were married in London. And I think now of you know, apart from all the things that happened at Fairridge and the issues I've still got with a lot of that stuff, some of my biggest issues I think now are the fact that I was given away basically by my parents, and people will argue against that, but my mother says she had no idea where we'd gone or anything else, but then when she came over here, she told me she sent us letters and parcels and everything else. So if you can send letters and parcels to somebody and you don't know where they are, pretty clever, I guess. But anyway, she passed away about 3 years ago, and while I was ecstatic when I first met her, just as I was when the Prime Minister apologised and Malcolm Turnbull apologised, I was ecstatic then too, but that's worn off. But that's another issue. We can probably go into that with questions and answers later. But my mother and I had this sort of a 5-minute relationship, I'd call it. It was probably a little bit longer than that. But at the end of the day, the more I found out, the more inclined I was to sort of say, well, you walked away from me all those years ago, and now, while it's too long, so don't make it right, that's how I feel. I feel like walking away, and Sandra will verify this. Sandra wanted me to go down and visit her when we were in England in 2004, and she basically had to drag me, and it was only a 10-minute walk. She basically had to drag me down there, and I had lost that emotional whatever it was that we'd had for a very short period of time. I don't want to take up any more of your time because I think we're running late now already, but like I say, I could talk for hours and hours, and I think I've been pretty good. I haven't been too emotional, but I'm very happy to be here. I was delighted when I was given the opportunity, when I was invited to come down and speak, and my dear friend Joanna recommended me, apparently. And I said yes before I even thought about it. And then when I thought about it after I put the phone down, I thought, what have I got myself into here? I'm not a public speaker. I'm a bloke that calls it as it is. I've got into lots of trouble for that from the day I first went into the orphanage, and I still get into trouble for it today. But that's me. And I look tough on the outside, but I'm pretty soft underneath. And as far as my achievements in life, I married... my first wife and I separated after 17 years. We had 3 children between us. She lives in the house that we used to live in together. Sandra and I got married a couple of years after that, and my first wife remarried also. We get on better now than we ever did in the 17 years we were married, which is not uncommon, I believe. But, we have 3 beautiful children between us and 12 grandchildren and a couple of great-great-grandchildren, and... Life goes on. I became a truck driver, just in finishing up. I became a truck driver, and I know lots of people don't like truck drivers for lots of different reasons, but every one of you are wearing the clothes that were carried by a truck driver, and you're sitting on a seat that was carried by a truck driver. So, yeah, somewhere along the line, you've got to start saying thanks for you guys. Everywhere I go, I try and get a plug-in for them, even though I'm retired now. But I served as a delegate in the yard. I worked for one of the biggest and best companies in Australia at the time in transport. Was Brambles for 31 years and loved every minute of it. And I'm retired happily now. I try to get involved with CLAN as much as I can and with the Old Free Bridges Association, of which Dale mentioned I'm the president. We have a reunion every 2 years up in Orange, and the next one comes up on the 10th and 11th of March this year. We have a dinner on the Saturday night, and a lot of us go out and visit the old farm school on the Saturday afternoon. Then on the Sunday we have an annual general meeting, but we only elect our office bearers every second AGM, which is not this year, it'll be the following year. We have planted in cooperation with the Molong Beautification Committee, a corridor of trees almost extending from the farm school into Molong, which is a distance of 3 miles. And these trees are on both sides of the highway, the Mitchell Highway. Each of them is sponsored by an individual child or staff member that went to Peerage, and they have a plaque at the bottom of each tree pointing out who paid for the tree, etc., etc. Our organisation's quite strong. We've got something like 260-odd known addresses of actual children that went through Fairbridge, plus about 40-odd associate members. Some of those were staff or children of former Fairbridge kids. We still call ourselves the Fairbridge kids. So that's about it, I think.
Thank you so much, Sharky. Interesting there that how children were punished for running away from abuse, and also that wonderful corridor of trees which I've seen, and very moving and powerful. And thank you so much, Sharky. We're glad that you're here, and there's nothing wrong with being emotional. It's an emotional history. So, but if I could hand it over to you, any questions?
Thank you. Thank you all so much. Thank you to Joanna before and to the panel. Much of what has been discussed today relates to practices of separating children from their parents and siblings, a practice which actually continues today, and we're seeing the rates of children in out-of-home care doubling every 10 years. So we can't actually say anymore that we don't know that this is happening. Your own stories resonate with many of the stories from parents involved in, for example, the Family Inclusion Network, which is a national network of parents who basically have children in care today. And if you actually Google Family Inclusion Network and Townsville, they've put together a fabulous YouTube video clip that goes for about 7 minutes. And children are removed today because of mental health issues, homelessness, drug and alcohol issues of their parents. My question is, if we are to learn anything from your experiences, particularly in relation to the role of parents and families when children are in out-of-home care, what would those lessons be? And what advice would you give to government, both at a Commonwealth level and to state child protection authorities, and I guess to a community as well, because we heard Joanna talk about how people don't really like hearing about these stories. And I guess my concern is that the trauma of past removal actually lives on, and it's not something that's finished and once the exhibition has ended here that it will go into a box and that we'll never think about again, because it's, as I said, the rate of removal is doubling every 10 years and we can't say we don't know about it. Thank you.
So your question then, sorry, just to sum up,
my question is, if we are to learn anything from your own experiences, particularly in relation to the role of parents and families when children are in care, what would those lessons be? I mean, Frank talked about when you went back through your records, seeing, you know, things in there about, you know, the terrible parents mustn't benefit. So I guess I'm particularly interested in that angle. And I think Joanna mentioned earlier too how we'll never hear the parents' stories.
Okay.
perfect for me. When I wrote my book, I wrote on two levels. That is my experience as a child growing up, and then the second story, the second level, is what was happening while I was growing up that I didn't know about until I was quite old. And I finished up saying I could forgive the vicious punishments, though my brother's sexual abuse, of course, is something that one really can't forgive. But nevertheless, I can forgive the bad food. I could forgive a lot of things. But the thing I could never really get out of my mind was, growing up all those years, isolated from my parents, who I knew were alive and out there somewhere, without ever being told why I was in the orphanage. And when I had children of my own, they would say, but Nana and Grandpa are okay. Why did you not grow up with them? I couldn't tell them. I'd make up all sorts of funny stories, and they'd ask for the funny stories as a distraction. So the thing I would say that's most important to me, and this may be different for various of us, is that you must engage the child in an understanding of what's going on in their life. Why are they there? What's the plan for the future? I mean, for me, it was just a matter of effluxion of time. When I'm 15, I'll do what my other two brothers did. I'll get a job and be pushed out. I mean, that's no way to grow up. You've got to grow up with an engagement with the people who are looking after you, an understanding of what's going on. So the lesson that I think is most important is engage the child in understanding of the situation, help them write the record, which so it won't become a big shock to them when they're 55 years old, because they would have been involved in writing the record of their time in the out-of-care situation all through. And they've got some grip of it. I was terribly impressed with a young woman who gave a talk in Melbourne recently. I think she's sort of early 20s, has a child of her own who's separated from her. But she's making every effort to document everything that happens so that when that little girl and she finally get back together, they'll have a common bond. They'll have some association with each other, which it will be the basis of a considered relationship. When I went back to my parents at age 15 and found they wouldn't talk to me about anything, it wasn't the most wonderful relationship. And I regret that I didn't know then what I knew, what I found out when I was 50-something, that they were actually wanting to get us back. I didn't know that. I would have had a different relationship. So the fact that the child is involved and engaged in understanding and perhaps contributing to the record about why they're in care would be the fundamental thing for me. But for others, it would be quite different, I'm sure.
Anyone else on the panel would like to add?
I think we need to put more money into keeping families together. I think, if we can prevent a child being separated from its family, we should do everything we can to do that first and foremost. And I know there'll always be families that's not possible. But I agree with Frank that the child should be involved. But I also agree that I did a presentation along with Frank for current people looking after kids, and one of the things we talked about was records and some of the shocks that we discovered when we found our records. I found a letter from my mother, and I only found it just very recently because I can't read my records. They're so awful about me as a little kid and how it's all my fault and what a manipulative, terrible child I was at 3 and 4. But I read this letter the other day, and it was my mother asking where was I, and she wanted me back. And one of her line was, "You don't know how this feels for someone else to have your child, and you don't know where that child is, how that child is." And she said, "I'm a nervous wreck." And up until I'd read that letter, which was only a couple of weeks ago, I always believed she didn't want me. That's what I was told all my life, that she didn't want me. She didn't love you. You're no good. So I think, you've got to teach the people writing the records as well. When we talked at this forum, people said, "Oh, we write down all the things that are bad about the kids. They had a bad day, they smashed up a room, they did this." She said, "I never thought to write the good things." So,
yes. The record about the parents is also very negative often.
Definitely. Yeah. And we, you know, where I work, we're working with one family who are fifth generation forgotten Australians or care leavers or whatever you like to call us. Their kids have just been taken from them, and that's the fifth generation. And where does it stop? How do we stop it?
Thank you. Thank you, Caroline. Are there any other questions? Hugh.
Understand the federal government apologising to child migrants like us, because the federal government was responsible for sending us to Australia, and in many cases some very cynical ways of getting us to Australia. We were taken from children's homes in the UK. Many children were told their parents had died. Once the child was on the way to Australia, they then told the parents the child had died. It was a way of severing the relationship between child and parent. Now, I can understand that an apology, if it focused on that and it hasn't, I can understand that's an apology. When it comes to what we call forgotten Australians, and I don't, I call them abandoned Australians, because that's what they were. What have the state governments been doing? Because every child in every children's home and or institution was a ward of the state that they lived in. And I've heard very little about what the states are doing. And I would be very interested in anyone's opinion of that.
Caroline, do you want to comment on?
Well, for a start, every child in an institution was not necessarily a ward of the state. Some parents were paid and jailed because they couldn't keep up the payments. Some kids slipped through the cracks. I know when I met my brother, we tried to get records for him so we could compare to see if that filled in a story. He was never made a ward of the state. Who knows why? So, no, they weren't all wards of the state. exactly right. So we weren't.
Joanna just said 50% were not wards of the state.
And I don't quite
approximately.
Yeah, and I don't quite understand what your question is. Is it why did the federal government apologise to forgotten Australians? They have. Every state government has now made an apology. Yes, they have. Sorry? They made a public apology. They all did. Yes. Yeah, they did. Yeah.
And memorials. So states have...
All of us, none of us say... Sorry. That it's enough. It's never enough. And we know that. But they are starting. And this is part of, you know, them getting to know the issues and the ongoing needs. And, you know, the Commonwealth, I think, have led the way with our apology and with the services that they have now implemented. I don't know.
It seems that we've only scratched the surface today, and I know with this history and this living history, there is so much more that needs to be spoken about. But we've touched on today about apologies, about services, about records, support groups, redress, and the importance of heritage. So something for all of us to pick up and go on with. And there are books. Orphans of the Living is in the museum bookshop. An Orphan's Escape, Frank Golding's book. Bonnie Durick's two books, Abandon All Hope, A History of Parramatta Girls Industrial School, The Importance of Place There, and also 14 Years of Hell, Hay Girls Institution, 1961 to 1974. And Sharkey also mentioned David Hill's book about Fairbridge in Molong. And our colleagues, the National Library of Australia, are next Monday from 2 to 4, there's a public forum on exploring sexual violence and institutionalisation in the ACT. National Library have kindly been the venue for that, and that's organised by various women's groups in the ACT. Exploring Sexual Violence and Institutionalisation in the ACT, next Monday, Conference Room, National Library, next Monday, 2 till 4 p.m. It's with great regret that I end it here, because I'm sure there is so much we need to talk about, and let us do so. But for now, would you join me in thanking Joanna Penglaze, Frank Golding, Caroline Carroll, Bonnie Durick, and Sharkey Moriarty.
And I would like to thank you all for coming for what you must all agree has been a very, very special event. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.